Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, John Clayton.
Welcome to Schooled with a Professor, and little history lesson right now. We're going to go into the history of passing in the National Football League, and the book's coming out next month. It's going to be December 15th, and looking forward to it. Baugh to Brady is going to be, you know, kind of the history of what's gone on with the passing game, and joining us right now is Lou Friedman, who's written that book. And I mean, football has been an evolution of being from a running game, a defensive game, to now it's a passing game. And so first off, Lou, what got you to get into this book and talk about the way that the forward pass has evolved?
Sammy Baugh. I have always been a huge fan of Sammy Baugh. And in my, I am one of those people who believes that he was probably the greatest football player of all time based on one thing, the fact that he made all-star teams as a quarterback, a defensive back, and a punter. But for me, of course, him as a thrower, and for the rest of the world, that was the number one thing. And he came along at a time where, I mean, as you just mentioned, it's been an evolution. You know, the football always was a running game going back to the flying wedge. And very slowly and gradually over time, the offenses have opened up until we see like a tilt completely almost in the other direction now, where running backs are almost an afterthought for many teams.
Yeah, I know. And of course, the book is called Baugh to Brady, The Evolution of the Forward Pass. You know, it's funny because I guess, you know, being, I guess, a historian of sorts, I mean, I always mention and keep Sammy Baugh in the mix of the top quarterbacks ever because, and then of course, when you do that, I mean, everybody says, who's Sammy Baugh? And of course, I mean, describe what he was as a quarterback.
Well, you have to return to the time period. By the time Sammy Baugh was a star in college at Texas Christian University, although they did win a bowl game 3-2, I believe, somewhere in there in the rain. So he probably wasn't that much of a thrower that day. But he comes out of the college in the Southwest and he joins up with the Washington Redskins. And this is a time where there's been about four tops well-known quarterbacks in NFL history who are just kind of feeling their way with the passing game. And they wanted a star in Washington. The Redskins, fewer people remember that the Redskins actually got their start in Boston than remember Sammy Baugh. And when they were moving to the new city, they wanted to make a splash, and they wanted star power. And so Baugh's selection was very deliberate in the draft. And he already brought with him a strong arm, a background with his college coach, Dutch Meyer, who had an interest in the passing game and honed it. So he was ready to throw in the pros at a time when almost nobody else was. And he made a big splash right away just by having an offense that let him throw the ball more than five times a game.
And so, and how much resistance do you think that he had back then? Because, I mean, one thing we know about the National Football League, it resists change. And if something's going to be different, that's not going to be positively reviewed because, you know, football likes to go a certain way. So how much resistance was there when he was out there slinging Sammy Baugh?
Well, actually, he did not find much resistance because his timing was so good. In the early 30s, 32, 33, the NFL realized it was running a stagnant game, really, and the fans wanted more offense. So they put in some rules that opened up the game. It used to be that if you threw an incomplete pass, you were penalized for it. If you you could hit the quarterback after he released the ball. So there were a lot of things stacked against the quarterback, and they changed the rules. And then he came along a year or two later, and they wanted star power, and they wanted more offense. So they wanted what he could deliver. So his timing was really excellent. And that probably, more than anything, set him up to be the guy that we remember.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, if he was a quarterback now, who would he compare to as far as his body type, the way he throws, the way he was? Is there one quarterback right now that would mirror what slinging Sammy Baugh was to get a picture for everybody?
I'm not sure I have that picture clearly, but I will say, compared to the quarterbacks now, he'd be a small guy because he only played at about 180 pounds. or so. So there were no big prototypes. Like, I think when we think of the change in the size of the quarterback, probably go back to the 1960s and come across a guy like Roman Gabriel. Because I remember when I was young, they were always talking about how big he was. And he is kind of about a 6'4", 220 guy, which we see every day now. So Boss, size-wise, doesn't have it. Nobody compares to him in that way. I don't know. For some reason, I just think of him as like a Drew Brees, though, mm-hmm. when it comes to throwing. I may be off on that, but it comes to mind more like that than, say, you know, Manning or Brady.
See, and that's the... That's the unusual part about the growth of this sport, because I still remember started covering in the 1970s. I mean, the offensive linemen, particularly covering the Steelers, they were like 230, 240. The biggest offensive lineman was Larry Brown at 275. And now, I mean, if you have a 295-pound center, he's considered to be almost too light and can be overpowered. I mean, the size of the game has grown because the way that the bodies have grown. But back then, it was so much different.
Oh, actually, I remember when I was a kid, you know, Ernie Ladd was the biggest guy in football at about 310 in the AFL with the Chargers. And then even before that, you had the outlier was Big Daddy Lipscomb. I mean, he was the only guy, I think, in football in the late 50s who weighed 300.
Oh, yeah. In fact, even William the Refrigerator Perry back in the early 1980s, I mean, he was one of the few 300-pound guys. Now, you had maybe a couple other guys that were that big, and they stood out. But now the sport has grown with the bodies that have grown, and it's really made for a different game. What, after slinging Sammy Baugh, who was the next quarterback to start to move the meter?
Sid Luckman, right? Actually contemporary of Sammy Baugh's, but only a few years later. And it became a situation in the late 1930s and the late 1940s, early 40s, before World War II, where they were the two guys who were like equal on their own plateau, way above everybody else who was playing the game. And they alternated championships, it seemed like, in that stretch, too. So it was as good as the Bears were, Baugh could elevate the Redskins. And they had some extremely famous championship games, the most amazing of which was the 70-3 Bears game over the Redskins. But then right after that, the Redskins came back and beat them in a title game when no one thought they could. So it was pretty much Baugh and Luckman, and they had a great respect for each other. I mean, everything I ever read, they just admired each other's talents. They would talk about each other as being the best kind of thing. And Luckman had a couple of achievements, especially his 7-touchdown passing game, which is still the NFL record, as we know, tied by about 7 or 8 other guys. But he was the first one to throw 7 touchdowns in a game. And when he got that record, the record of 6 had been set by Baugh only perhaps weeks or a month earlier.
Interesting. Now, the one thing that you see that when you have two players that can stick out like that, and you see it right now, if you have a great quarterback, then you really have a chance. If you don't have a great quarterback, you're in the back of the pack. Was there then the desire after seeing Luckman and Baugh to go find quarterbacks like that, but maybe they just weren't available at that time?
I think that was absolutely the case, but I think it took a number of years, pretty much almost getting into them. Mid to late 40s, with the exception of the Packers. The Packers, Curly Lambeau was an early believer in the passing, going back even to when the team was founded, you know, in 1919, 1920. And he had Cecil Isabel and, Arnie Herbert, and they were both great quarterbacks. They didn't have the talent of Baugh or Luckman, but they had the offense that periodically really let them shine. And even though the numbers that they put up would be laughable now, but compared to what's going on, they led the league in various categories over a several-year period. They also had the one secret weapon that the rest of the NFL did not have, and that was Don Hutson, who was at the same time virtually inventing the receiver position. So they knew if they threw it up, Hutson could come down with it.
Do you have an adjustable rate mortgage that is about to increase? or first and second mortgage that you would like to combine into one. Low mortgage payment? Hey, give Keel Mortgage a call today. They are local, friendly, and have been serving families up and down the West Coast for over three decades. With interest rates forecasted to rise, the best time to explore your options is now. It starts with a phone call to 1-888-778-KIEL or online at keelmortgage.com. That's Keel Mortgage, 888-778-KIEL. They can help. CL53969. How simplistic were the routes that they ran? That was because again, I'm sure it's not like the current nine route tree that is out there with complexities as far as making adjustments to zone and man, all that stuff. How basic were the routes?
My impression after my reading was they were as basic as the kind almost that you and I might have played in the street in front of our house as kids. Go long. I'm going to go as far as that parked car, mm-hmm. even though they didn't have the car, but it would just be, well, I'm going to turn when I feel like it. And nobody had seen anybody who made very many moves like that or had the speed that Hudson had. So he was literally leaving people in their dust on a dirt field, a dirt and grass field. They didn't know what to do. One of my most fun anecdotes I've ever read was Willie Mays, of course, in another sport, explaining how he sometimes learned how to make daring fielding catches by watching Don Hudson and run his routes along the sidelines. And I'm not sure exactly how that translated, but it certainly implied that Hudson was making an impression on everybody with the way he moved.
Fascinating. And so now you take the next step as far as the forward pass. Who is the next quarterback or group of quarterbacks to move the meter?
I'm thinking like Otto Graham, who's next, pretty much leading to Johnny Unitas, in a sense. There was, and then we get more and more guys. You have guys who you don't even remember now, who suddenly had trained more in college and were more passing ready when they came out. And some of those guys started dotting, the lineups. And you'd have Bob Waterfield. We're now like late 40s, early 50s. And Norm Van Brocklin, that era. Probably, of course, the biggest winner among all of those was Otto Graham. I think you could say he pitched for seven championship teams in 10 years.
What made him so good? What type of style did he have that worked so well?
I think he was a guy who adapted. Well, these other guys were still learning how to throw long. My impression with Graham is he kind of threw more of some of those short passes that moved the chain than that we see now as a common thing when nobody else was doing that. It was kind of, I got the impression the NFL went through a period with quarterbacks where it was kind of all or nothing, Go deep, and we're going to throw it as far as my arm will let it fly. But Graham was better at picking up defenses apart during that period. And, of course, at that time, the Browns also had a terrific running game. And that's pre-Jimmy Brown, with guys like Marion Motley. And so that was leading into the Jimmy Brown era, actually.
Yeah.
The biggest problem the Browns ever had is they didn't have Otto Graham when they had Jim Brown. I had to go to I guess Milt Plum was pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Then, of course, you start to get to Johnny Unitas, and that's, I think, when the modern passing game started to evolve because Johnny Unitas was so good putting together those two-minute drives, the fourth-quarter comebacks, and really just taking control of games at the end of games.
He was sort of the pioneer of that. But you can't forget the AFL's influence. Starting with 1960, where they tried to play a more wide-open game. And the refugee from the NFL, one of George Halas's greatest mistakes, was George Blanda. Kicking off the era of really deep passing and frequent passing in the AFL. He had 36 touchdown passes in a year, right around the same time Y.A. Tittle did it for the Giants in the early 60s, when that was the record. And for the Oilers, I believe Charlie Hennigan had 101 catches in a year in the early 60s. That was unheard of, and that was working with Blanda. So the AFL was advancing the passing game. For one thing, they had Sidney Gilman coaching the Chargers, who was, sort of a pioneer of integrating more creative offensive plays into his passing game.
Yeah, it's funny when you see a high-scoring game right now, you almost go back and say that's almost like an AFL game. I still remember, I can't remember if it was like it was New England and Denver. It was like a 51-48 game that was just wild and crazy. And, you know, there were so many fun quarterbacks to watch in the AFL.
Yeah, but yeah, they really emphasized it. And Al Davis played a role in that with Oakland, too. He always went after the best available athlete, you know, so they had great receivers even back then. Guy like Art Powell, who's not well remembered, whose brother was a heavyweight boxing contender. I was at the first Boston Patriots game ever played at home. However, they did not have a great quarterback there. Yeah.
No. Then I still remember the 70s right after the merger. It was one where they still didn't pick up as much on the passing game because you would have Bob Greasy, even Terry Bradshaw go out there in some games only throw 9 to 13 passes and just try to run the ball. So it really took until Bill Walsh to come in and start to really push the passing game.
Yeah, he was an innovator. I mean, nowadays, actually, that's the big flaw. If you don't have a great quarterback right now, and I mean almost someone who's great, you're not going to win a Super Bowl title right now. It's hard to believe you could because there's so much emphasis on, you know, the way the clock is used even with the pass. I mean, the short passing game now is the equivalent of the running game. I mean, where have all those running backs gone? I mean, they do still run the ball in college sometimes, don't they?
Occasionally, yeah. But here's the weird part is, like, if you go, like, in the AFL or in the AFC, there's only been four quarterbacks that have been Super Bowl winners since, like, 2001 or 2002, and that's Tom Brady, Peyton Manning on two different teams, Joe Flacco, and Ben Roethlisberger. And so if you weren't one of those four, you weren't winning a Super Bowl.
But part of it was the problem of Tom Brady hogging it off, but...
Yeah.
I mean, but even like you look at the recent era on the other side, I mean, Brett Favre set some standards after, you know, but, and he actually eclipsed Dan Marino. He was a big factor in there. He never won his Super Bowl, but he certainly had those stats in terms of throwing touchdown passes and yards. And Drew Brees is kind of like that now. He just keeps moving up the ladder. I mean, he doesn't get talked about because he's eclipsed by guys like Tom Brady, but if he sticks around another few years, if he outlasts Tom Brady, he might end up with all the records.
Very well might. How impactful was that 1983 draft that had John Elway, Dan Marino, six first-round quarterbacks, and guys that really helped advance the game for the passing?
I'm not so sure. I think some of it's the luck of timing. You know, of course, guys have to be the right age to be in that draft, but not all six of them, you know, became stars. Isn't Todd Blackledge in that group?
Yep.
Ken
O'Brien.
You know, of course, Elway.
Yeah, Ken O'Brien was in that group, too, was not a star.
Yeah, I mean, they were there, and it just... I'm not sure how much influence they really had. You had the individuals who stood out. But, I mean, do we know who's drafted last year? I mean, we got some starters already, right, who are playing pretty well. Recent draft picks, you know, we don't know where they're going long time right now, but like, you know, like Mariota, Carson, Wentz, and guys like that right now, we don't know what their long-term value will be, but it seems like it's still possible to be, you know, have a year where you, or two, where you have a bunch of guys and they do take over and emerge.
No question.
You know, it's, you know, you've watched the game so long, you know what a, you know, what a shot in the dark it is.
Well, I'm watching Deshaun Watson before he suffered his ACL injury. It was just an absolute treat because he took a lot of the Clemson offense. Bill O'Brien was calling incredible stuff. I mean, he was doing stuff that was like triple. It was like wishbone passing offense that was play action downfield. I mean, it was incredible stuff to watch, and that's why it was so sad to see Watson go down for the season because now you don't get to appreciate how good it was,
right,
and how unique it was.
Well, it's always just enjoyable for any football fan, regardless of what team they're on, if a new electrifying player comes in the league. It's just that much fun to watch. It makes you want to turn on the game. You don't care even who's playing who so much as you want to see that guy with the ball. And
now,
that's a treat. And it's more so, I guess, if it's a quarterback because he's got the ball all the time.
Yeah. Now, of course, I guess the question is, we go from Baugh, we go to Brady. Is Brady the greatest quarterback ever, or where does he stand?
Again, you know, you got. I think different people have different criteria. Is he the greatest quarterback ever? In many cases, for many reasons, you could say yes, because he's won the most. And if you just say that's case closed, that's your opinion. You could say who has the most stats of all time, touchdown passes, yards. He may end up with those too, in which case that would solidify the argument. But, I mean, how many people have won multiple championships and had the stats? But I assume there are still people alive who are longtime football fans who would give that nod to Johnny Unitas and just say it was a different era. And if he had been able to play in this era where he threw all that time, then we'd be talking about him. I'm not sure. And then in between, there were people who referred to Joe Montana for a little while as the greatest ever, and that was based on his leadership. See, there's where you get into the issue where it's an intangible. How much does that count? Winning the Super Bowl and intangibles as a leader versus, you know, black and white numbers. If you put it all together and you got longevity too, then right now I'd say Brady's probably leading the pack.
No doubt. The book is Baugh to Brady, The Evolution of the Forward Pass. It comes out December the 15th. And Lou Friedman, how does everybody get a hold of this book?
Well, it's from the Texas Tech University Press, which is also a good tie-in to Baugh because they were based in Texas, even though they weren't his school. And since it's not out yet, I mean, it can be pre-ordered through their website, I think. And that's a school that's had a history of some offense, too.
They sure have, no doubt about that.
Yeah,
there's a coach in Washington State that is still waiting for some paychecks.
And do you know where he's from? Cody, Wyoming.
And which is where you are at right now.
That's right, Mike Leach.
There you go, that's fantastic. Hey, Lou Friedman, thanks so much for joining us, and I'm looking forward to reading the book.
Thank you for having me.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with a Professor.